This is Valley of Genius, Episode 3, Nolan Bushnell.
What happened was we had the tiger by the tail. We had more orders than we could fill.
Welcome to the Valley of Genius, a brand new podcast from the TWiT Network, audio only, inspired by our conversation on triangulation a few weeks back with author Adam Fisher. Adam is a writer for Wired Magazine, MIT Technology Review. He's written for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And his book, Valley of Genius, is a compendium, hand-edited on the floor with scissors and paste, of more than 200 interviews with the hackers, founders, and freaks who made Silicon Valley boom. Adam, it's great to have you back.
Great to be here, Leo.
It's fun to go through these. Tell me how you got Nolan Bushnell. First of all, actually, tell me who Nolan Bushnell is.
Nolan Bushnell will be remembered as one of the most important cultural figures of the century. He essentially invented the video game industry. He did the first arcade video game, the first video game where
Pong.
He could... Actually, that is not the first.
Really?
No, surprise.
He did do Pong.
He did do Pong.
It's the first one I ever played. I remember spending a day, a very bad day, in a bar with white Russians and Pong. I had never seen such a thing, and I played it for hours.
With a friend.
No. Well, I must have, right? You can't play it alone.
Can't play it alone. It was a social game. It was a dating game.
I'll never forget it. It was like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So what was his first game?
It was called Computer Space.
Now, he's going to talk about this. But before he does, I want you to set the scene. Where are you talking to him? Do you remember?
Yeah, I went down to L.A. Sorry, I had to get it.
I'm getting a strange look.
Sorry, I had to be like, I've talked to him on the phone.
How many people have you talked to?
A couple hundred.
And,
you know, I'm talking for days at a time, not just some phone call.
Oh, this is an ongoing process.
I did Nolan for 2 days in a
row. You were very fortunate to get that much time with him.
Yeah.
That's really great.
But I visited him in his office. He has another startup. He always has a startup in L.A., some kind of educational software company.
Yeah. So here he's talking about the first computer game he ever saw.
He saw Space War, which ran on a mainframe.
I believe that it was between 1965 and 1966 at the University of Utah. I think I was actually a junior. Evans and Sutherland was clearly a leader, and in fact, it yielded a whole bunch of what we call Utah brats. You know, Jim Clark and Warnock, Alan Kay, Ivan Sutherland, Ed Catmull. They were graduate students, and I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And so I was in their thrall. More, but I knew who they were, and they were kind of big guys. I felt that the work that they were doing was truly extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It was literally in the middle of the night. My fraternity brother said, you know, there's something over here you've got to see. And we stealthily went into the lab. I think he jammed something in the lock mechanism so that we could just get in, and we didn't turn the lights on. You know, it was just us and the green screen display glowing back at us. It was the same big round, you know, converted radar display. I mean, it came basically from the Korean War, and it was a life-changing experience for me. To put it in context, I was manager of the games department, the games, you know, Midway Games and the arcades at the amusement park, and that was my summer job, and so I knew intimately the economics of the coin-operated game business.
He was a carny. He was a...
Wait a minute. When you say carny, I see a guy with one tooth, a four-day-old beard, kind of a smell of rum about him. He wasn't that kind of carny.
He wasn't that carny. So he was getting his engineering degree,
yeah.
And he was literally the worst engineer in the department. But what he excelled at was his kind of summer job, which was saying, hey, step right up, you know, throw the ball. He was just kind of selling carnival games, and he quickly became the head of, you know, that all the kids who were doing this.
Neat. So he comes to Silicon Valley. Now, at that time, Silicon Valley wasn't the Silicon Valley we think of with the tilt-ups and all the big companies. It was just a farmland, pretty much.
Yes, although they were producing silicon. They were doing chips, but doing chips for the military-industrial complex.
Right.
And it was engineers, buttoned-up engineers with the pocket protectors, that kind of clock in at 8, go home at 5 culture. HP, Intel.
Right.
Fairchild.
Very buttoned down.
Buttoned up.
Here's Nolan talking about his first visit to Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley was really starting in a lot of ways. For example, there were these large tracts of prune orchards, and every month there'd be a prune orchard that was taken down, and they'd pile all the trees up and say free firewood, and then, you know, a few months later there'd be a concrete tilt-up there. And the sort of center of gravity tended to be Mountain View, Sunnyvale, where there was Fairchild and Intel and National Semiconductor, and I worked for Ampex, which was from, you know, their headquarters was Redwood City, but they had a division in Santa Clara called Videophile. But you know, everything east of 101 was just basically marshland. There's nothing there. Mm-hmm. And everything was pretty much clustered along the Central Expressway. It was very interesting. Like, I wore a coat and tie to work every day as an engineer at Videophile. However, we all had our hippie costumes. And we would, dress in our hippie costumes and go to San Francisco and pretend we were flower children, you know, the ultimate posers, if you would. And nobody thought anything of it. That was just something that you did. You know, you worked, and then you played. And I know that for me, California was magical. And every weekend, we'd go somewhere. You know, whether it was up the Sonoma Coast or down to Carmel or over to Yosemite or what have you, we were in the process of discovering this new world. Mm-hmm. And, of course, San Francisco and the hippie culture was really fascinating to us. And I became infatuated with the game of Go. Mm-hmm. And I would drive to San Francisco every other weekend and spend basically most of Sunday morning playing Go, mm-hmm. at the old Buddhist church on Bush Street. Mm-hmm. And this was a building that was almost falling down, mm-hmm. but it was magical to me. And then I found out that there was a Go club that met on Wednesday night at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And to find people who played Go in California was really hard. And so I started going to the Go club on Wednesday night and met a guy named Jim Stein.
Okay.
Jim Stein was working at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab. And one day, after we were playing Go, we got talking about various things, and he said, "Have you ever heard of Space War?" I said, "Space War, yeah!" And he said, "Let's go up and play." Boy, bingo. And we left the Stanford campus, drove up to the Artificial Intelligence Lab was up on the hill behind Stanford. And we went up and we played until all hours of the night. And that in some ways was the recatalyzation of the idea for the video game.
So he's really excited about his memories of Space Wars, sees an ad for a computer and says, hey, wait a minute, we could make our own Space Wars.
Coincidentally, there was an ad for a Nova, a general data Nova computer, which was 800 kilohertz clock cycle. And it looked like you could get a stripped down version of it for about $4,000. And I thought, ah, the time is right. A $4,000 computer, but the displays, these big XY displays, were about $20,000 at the time. And so clearly that wasn't the thing. So I said, my help to this, or my addition, I will figure out a way to do a regular television set driven by this computer. To put this in context, this was probably October. And October of 69. And so I was continuing to try to solve this timing problem, trying to solve the timing problem. And during the Thanksgiving holiday that in November of that year, I abandoned the project. I said, it just isn't going to work. There's the computer's not fast enough. Raster scan just takes the takes data too fast. And I abandoned it for probably 2 days. And then I got the epiphany that let's not use the mini computer at all. I'll do it all in hardware. Because what I've been doing to get rid of the time constraints is I built a little circuit that would create the stars. And I built a little circuit that would put the score up. And various things so that it offloaded tasks on the from the computer. And the minute that happened, it's just like the circuitry almost designed itself. It was an immediate success, just cash dropping through. What we didn't realize is that it was a hard game to play, and engineers loved it. If you were a working man with a beer in your hand, you were totally clueless as to what was going on. And so the game did well around college campuses, did nothing in a working man's bar. And in fact, you know, people say that Computer Space was a failure, but it was really, it did about $3.5 million, which was a lot of money in those days, and the royalties of it allowed me to start Atari. It was a winner for me.
The voice of Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, and really, who was it? Scott Hosanna characterized him as the first T-shirt CEO.
So it was Michael Malone.
Oh, it was Michael Malone.
He was the first T-shirt tycoon. You know, he was the first guy to realize that Silicon Valley could make consumer products, could change the culture.
Right.
And he was really the first, you know, young, brash CEO. Before, it was, you know, Hewlett and Packard. You know, it's like these buttoned-up guys. But this is like a kid in his 20s who's got the world by its balls, right?
But it wasn't that there weren't arcades and games, but they were pinball games. And, of course, at the time, the biggest of them all was Bally.
That's correct.
I go to Bally and say, would you like to license? I'd like to license you my next game, but it's going to cost you this much a month in development. And they said, yeah, we'd love to do it. Al Alcorn was a work-study engineer from Berkeley. And the way they worked it is they would work in the industry for 6 months, then they'd go back to Berkeley for 6 months, then they'd work in the industry for 6 months. And Al was on his second tranche at Ampex. He was my tech, and I needed a training project for him because Computer Space was pretty complex, and I felt that, and we had contracted with Bally for a driving game,
which would take little cars and, you know, and, you know, it was going to be a hard project. And I thought, okay, I'm going to pitch him a this learning project, this ping pong game. And I told him that I had a contract with General Electric or something. I don't remember, because I find that people don't like training projects or dead-end projects. And so it was a little fabrication. And Al basically had the thing going, I think, in a week, as I remember. It might have been a week and a half. And it it was fun. It started out not to be fun because the angle off the paddles was angle incidence, angle reflection. And so it was strictly a defensive game. And so we decided to segment the paddle so that if you hit the top of the paddle, it would go up instead of just angle incidence, angle reflection. And that made it fun. But now the game started to go too long. And so we decided to speed up the ball after so many volleys, and then we, and it was still, you could still get good enough that the game would last too long, so we then cut the paddle in half. Because in a coin-operated game, you want most of the people to lose in 3 minutes. You know, it's just kind of the rules. And I thought to myself, maybe Bally would like this game instead of the driving game.
Now, of course, in these days, the whole ecosystem of venture capital, angel investors, none of that exists yet. That's something that came later. So Nolan's got a game, but he doesn't have any money.
He doesn't have any money. And he realizes that Pong is a huge moneymaker. And he realizes, actually, on the plane coming back from Bali, that he can actually manufacture himself. Because Pong was the first Atari game. Computer space was manufactured by someone else. And he realizes he can get basically 90 days credit for all the parts from the that he needs. And if he can build it and sell it faster than 90 days, he is cash flow positive. And so immediately, these two 20-something-year-olds throw together a manufacturing company, a hardware manufacturing company, and they start pumping out Pong games. They buy a roller or rent a roller skating rink and hire a bunch of hippie dropouts to run around on roller skates and put these things together.
What happened was we had a tiger by the tail. We had more orders than we could fill. I can remember telling Alcorn and Dabney that we were going to move production up to 100 a day, and they looked at me like I was just stark raving mad. And that's where we had to get a lot of space and various things. But I figured out how we could finance it, and that was the issue. But understand that we had no purchasing department, no manufacturing skill. We had no procedures. We had no quality control. We had nothing, you know. And so we were literally making it up as we were going along. We were working a lot of times, and we were working hard and playing hard. And people talk about the party atmosphere. What they don't realize is that it was all based on hitting quotas. And we had an extremely young workforce. The girls that were stuffing the computer boards and doing the testing were like in their early 20s. Some of them were 18 and 19. The guys who were muscling the big boxes around and packing them and shipping them were all in their early 20s. And so what everybody wanted was a party with some beer and some pizza, and they'd end up going home with each other. It was the hippie lifestyle, and everybody was happy.
So he's got a skating rink, he's got a bunch of hippies and junkies assembling what is it? The Atari game? What is it? The Pong game?
Pong. Arcade Pong.
It's an arcade game.
And then there was like Quadra Pong and Doubles Pong and all these Pongs. Woz creates Breakout, which is essentially Color Pong for one person.
That's a story. Listen to our first episode to hear that story.
So et cetera, et cetera. And he's actually, you can't copyright this stuff at that time. And he's getting ripped off left and right. And then he says, okay, my next move is to do the VCS, the 2600, Pong at Home. That's the cartridge machine. Remember that, Leo?
I remember it. I bought it. That was my entry, my gateway drug into technology, because I'd been dropping a lot of money at the arcade, and I said, maybe if I just buy this VCS, the Atari video game console, I can save myself some money. That was my rationalization.
Exactly. But to build something like the VCS takes an incredible amount of capital.
There were no home video games at this time.
There was. The Magnavox.
Magnavox Odyssey had come out first. Okay.
Had come out first.
And it was terrible.
It was terrible, but interestingly enough, Arcade Pong came after the Magnavox Odyssey Tennis for Two and was a copy of that game.
I didn't know that. Now, I remember the Magnavox, you had to put an overlay on the TV. I think I may be wrong on
before
this.
Before my time,
yeah,
Leo.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's
there was no sound. There was
it was
no
very
sound.
Primitive.
It was very primitive. There's no keeping score.
There was a market then. People knew that, well, maybe there is something in the home that you could.
Yeah, and remember, the Magnavox was just Pong, whereas this VCS would have cartridges.
Right.
Okay? So, brilliant idea. He just needed a lot of capital, and he to do it. And so he turned to the market. They were going to do an IPO, but they just couldn't. It was a bad season. And so Warner Brothers comes kind of. The movie company.
Wow. Yeah, of course they want to be in home entertainment.
We had been running the company with tricks and mirrors from a cash standpoint, even with the venture capital infusion, which I think was like $3 million or something like that. That gave us cash flow, but it didn't. But it was very clear that the launch of the VCS was going to consume a massive amount of capital. Mm-hmm. We had to build a whole big new factory. We had to, you know, there was a lot of, you know, not only were we going to be building these consoles, but we had to build all the cartridges and package them, and It was just, we knew that it was going to be a very successful product, but we knew that there was no way we could cash flow it into the consumer marketplace. So that being the underpinnings, several of the people came and kind of kicked the tires and looked around a little bit. And then Manny Girard came from Warner and said that the chairman, Steve Ross, had been with their kids at Disneyland and played Atari games for a full afternoon and had instructed him to go see about it. Mm-hmm. And so we had some good preliminary conversations, and he said, well, why don't you come back to New York and let's see we can negotiate a deal. And so they said, we'll send the jet. Never been on a private jet before. Climbed up, into this, G2, I think it was at that time. Very posh. A stunning stewardess that was willing to give you any kind of drink or alcohol or what have you, and life was good. And they said, hope you don't mind, but we're going to have to stop in Sun Valley and pick up another guest who happened to be Clint Eastwood. So anyway, all of a sudden, you're feeling like really big shit. We get into New York, picked up by a limousine, swept off to the Waldorf Towers, not just the Waldorf Towers. There was Gene Lipkin, myself, there were four of us on the team, and We were in an apartment that had a pool table and a grand piano. And, I mean, it was a nine-room suite, you know. Our normal fare when we were really spending a lot of money, it was a Holiday Inn. So anyway, they were clearly warming us up. Mm-hmm. Next day we go up, meet Steve Ross, sort of negotiate and talk about the various opportunities. Mm-hmm. They talk a little bit about the form of the deal, what have you. And we sort of come to a handshake agreement as form and structure by probably 4 or 5 o'clock that night. They started killing off some of the projects that we were working on. And it was very interesting mindset because they could not see everything. Every prototype looked like a tiny business to them, not realizing that, you know, all businesses at the outset look like tiny businesses. Mm-hmm. And it was just a corporate culture that became very toxic. What we were planning on doing is to have a game network. And the network was going to be real simple. It was, we were going to have a room full, a closet full of computers in every area code, because in those days it was free. A local call was free, but long distance was very expensive. Mm-hmm. And we were then going to link the closets with a T1 line. Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about that, that's fundamentally the architecture of the internet. Mm-hmm. And if you look, and our IP stack was very, very similar to the internet IP stack. And that was killed. Now think about it, if Atari owned the internet, that would have been really cool. That would have been massively cool.
Okay, so Warner buys the company and they immediately mess it up. They thought they were buying the Cabbage Patch doll, you know, the new...
the next Christmas thing.
The next Christmas thing that would kind of give, you know, every year, you know, like Monopoly, they just sell and sell and sell. They had no idea, because really no one had any idea. They had no idea that they'd always have to be working on the next thing.
Right.
Right? And so, and the other thing that was happened is... you know, they refused to pay the programmers who were really building these games.
They didn't give them credit even.
They didn't give them credit. They didn't give them any extra money.
Yeah.
And a bunch of programmers first said, hey, look, why don't you give us like a real little royalty deal? Because this is a creative thing we're doing.
Right.
And they said, no, you're just a cog in the machine. This is Warner talking. And so they said, well, heck, we're going to just leave. And they went off and created Activision. And the first thing they did was reverse engineer the code so that they could also do cartridges. So this was a big lawsuit, but Activision won. And then Activision did a couple amazing games.
Yeah.
And
Pitfall.
Pitfall was the classic.
Yeah.
And then everybody got into the act, and the market became flooded with these horrible, horrible cartridge games. And, you know, your dad, you'd go to the store, you were...
And they weren't cheap. You spent 50, 30, 40 bucks on a game.
Well, the new Atari or the new Activision cartridge was 30, 40 bucks. But then, but they were out of stock because they were hits.
So you get $2.
So the dad says, oh, look at these $2 games. What's the difference? And bring home these $2 games. And the kid plugs them in and says, I hate my Atari VCS. And he puts it in the closet. Okay? And so... So then the next thing that happened was, you know, Christmas is coming up and Atari says, we need a hit. And Warner licenses the big hit.
The movie of the year.
The movie of the year.
E.T., the extraterrestrial.
Yeah, that chairman of Warner says to, hey, Steven, you know, Spielberg.
Spielberg.
How much? And Spielberg gives him a number, which is huge, and, you know, the chairman of Warner buys it and tells Atari, like, make a game, But it says you only have 6 weeks to do it because we got to hit Christmas.
And the story of the worst video game ever created. Here's Nolan Bushnell.
The reason I knew that it was going to be bad because I started to know how they were thinking. Mm-hmm. And rather than being driven by the economics of the market, they were being driven by the economics of the deal. Mm-hmm. It went from the engineers being superstars to the marketing department, mm-hmm. who, if you have the good product, any idiot can sell it. Mm-hmm. And they didn't realize. They just thought they were geniuses. And they knew that based on the royalty that they had to pay Spielberg, that the only way that the deal made sense was if they sold a certain amount of cartridges. And they knew that they could only sell those cartridges if they could ship it by a particular time. Mm-hmm. And so therefore the deal constrained the engineering time to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. The deal drove the economics, not the marketplace. People used to smuggle cartridges out to me, mm-hmm. prototypes. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd just burn them on a ROM. Mm-hmm. And I can remember getting the ET cartridge and thinking that it was broken. Literally. And I thought, this is broken. This is not what's going to happen.
The story of Atari is huge, and there's a lot more in the book. You've got to read it. Valley of Genius. Go to valleyofgenius.com/twit and get your copy. But to thank you for doing this show, you know, the E.T. game was so bad that Atari ended up burying all the remnants in Alamogordo, New Mexico.
Not only is it a rumor, it's actually true. And someone went to go dig it all up, and there they found it.
And you know how I know? And I'm going to give you this. I have a copy of E.T. for the Atari 2600.
No way.
This is a memento that you can have. I have two, so you keep one, and I'll keep one. Oh,
thank you so much.
Whatever you do, do not try to play this. The worst video game of all time. Next week, more of Valley of Genius. We'll talk with a guy whose name is little known, but really ought to be, the third founder of Google. Thanks, Adam Fisher.
Thank you, Leo.
Driving into the parking lot of our Winchester Avenue facility, and the parking lot was jammed. I couldn't find a parking spot. And it just kind of occurred to me that my company was paying the payments on every one of the cars in there. And it was kind of one of these things where I said, this is cool.